Welcome to Juno Afternoon, our first show for the month of May, and we will try not to disappoint, not if I have anything to do with it. Good afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride, your host for this hour. Coming up, The Spirit Wraps Around You is about to open. Why this State Museum exhibit is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Also, time out to recognize Gordon Jackson, who received this year's award for meritorious service from the University of Alaska Southeast. We'll get a pulse on the economy from the Juneau Economic Development Council and check in with the National Weather Service to find out what records have recently been set. Speaking of the weather, tonight and tomorrow, widespread rain showers, lows in the lower 40s, highs in the upper 40s, southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Juneau Afternoon will be right back after National Native News. You are listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. For those involved in a new exhibit at the State Museum, what is about to unfold this Friday sounds like much, much more than an exhibit, but almost a spiritual experience. Even the title gives you that feeling. The Spirit Wraps Around You, Northern North Coast Native Textiles. The exhibit opens with an online ceremony this Friday, and we are pulling together two very, very busy museum curators. We're pulling them away from their efforts to launch this exhibit so they can bring us up to date with what's going on, Steve Henriksen and Jackie Manning, and also joining us, Lily Hope, who is among a number of weavers who have helped to put this exhibit together. And first of all, starting with you, Steve, can each of you tell me briefly the emotions you're feeling right now as this exhibit is about to launch?
Well, it's I feel a great deal of relief and joy to have reached this point in the preparations. It's just a little nerve-wracking because some of our loans of robes for the exhibit haven't left the ground yet from the museums that are lending them. So it's still a little bit on pins and needles, I'd have to say, but things are looking pretty good.
Jackie?
You know, it's so far, it's looking just amazing. We're just down to some small details. And so when people walk in, they're just going to be just absolutely have an experience where they stop and they need to sit for a minute and take it all in. It really is looking incredible, and we're able to see that already.
So Lily Hope, as a weaver, you must have a special set of feelings for what's about to happen.
If bubbles are feelings, that's what I've got is bubbles. Just bubbling up, we got to do a volunteer fringe afternoon last week where we all, a number of us weavers, went in and straightened fringe on the blankets. And so many of us paused and cried. We literally cried in the space, like, how amazing is this? That, you know, so many of our ancestral weavers, like in our teaching lineage, are present, like Clarissa Rizal and Jenny Sanat. And then so many living weavers having their work elevated like this. I'm just all bubbles.
Well, we're going to let Steve tell us about the visiting robes that are coming home. But can you tell us about your role in putting together this amazing collection of robes that'll be part of the exhibit, Lily?
Sure. I guess it was more than 2 years ago, year and a half ago, that we started assembling in conference rooms. Pre-COVID, and there were four or five of us weavers, six weavers, and we were asked, like, what do you want to see? What story do you want to tell? How do you want to share the lineage of this, these textiles, both the Yeshkuwu Raven's Tail and the Nahein, or Nahin in Haida, or the Gwishalait in Simalagic Tsimshian language? So it's been collaborative the whole way, and we've felt supported and heard. It's been amazing to connect with the museum staff and, you know, the educational team and all of that, bringing this to the public.
Well, Jackie, this must be a museum curator's dream to have all of these different artists represented.
You know, it absolutely is. And it's been so lovely to be able to work with the weavers in planning the exhibit, deciding how to best display the robes, everything from the mount style to the colors they're displayed against. It's been an absolute dream to be able to collaborate on an exhibit like this, and kind of a once in a lifetime, I think, opportunity to be able to do this exhibit here. So I'm feeling very, very grateful for everybody who collaborated and participated.
I guess it is an opportunity just to see how rich this tradition is, or at least get a sense of it. But Steve, I guess everybody is eagerly awaiting two very, very old robes that are coming from museums outside of Alaska. Can you tell us about these robes?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been, just as a aside, I ran across my first proposal for this exhibit that was 30 years ago, actually, and almost to the day where we first threw out this idea. And for one reason or another, we never got to it until now. I think there's just a lot of really cool exhibit ideas out there that we've been following up on, but we finally got to this one. And I'll have to say that a lot of the vision that we had 30 years ago has really been realized in this show. And even though some of the players have changed, the weavers that I worked with originally were ones that were volunteering at the museum to weave a robe here. And there were quite a few of them that were all students of Cheryl Samuel. And we spent a lot of time kind of envisioning where this could go. At that time, Ravenstail weaving was just reemerging after about 150 years when no one was doing it anymore that we know of. And Cheryl Samuel was involved in envisioning this out. She was here teaching for the University of Alaska. We had mostly local weavers who helped on that project, who all participated in kind of fleshing out this vision. Marguerite Fiorella, Janet Schempf, Marcia Steyer, Janice Criswell, Bonnie Fitzgerald, Kayfield Parker, Kristen Trumbull, Mary Lou King, Joni Lewis, and Clarissa Hudson, Brazel, all had their 2 cents worth. And we came up with this vision of bringing some of the old robes here and having a show with the new robes. And so you could sort of get a sense of the evolution over the past 200 years of these art forms. There's Ravenstail weaving, a geometric style, and then Chilcat weaving, a more curvilinear style that uses a lot of clan crests. And we wanted to get at least one of the dozen Ravenstail robes, original ones, that were collected in the late 1700s, early 1800s for this exhibit, because there are no whole ones left in Alaska or even on the Northwest coast. So the one that we were able to get on loan that's supposed to be getting on an airplane in the next day or two is from the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. So there's that one. And then we have what is by many accounts the finest Chilcat robe in existence that's coming from the Peabody Museum at Salem, Massachusetts. And that's heading our way. It's a really famous design that has tinas on it, coppers. And we are hoping to get both of those installed by opening day, which is Saturday, maybe earlier. But we're not sure on the shipping yet, and the one has to go through customs still. But it's looking pretty good now for those to arrive. And when they're here, they'll meet several dozen new and old robes that we've put together for the show.
So Lily, would you describe to us the difference between Ravenstail and the Chilcat style and tell us what you're interested in seeing in these robes?
Ravenstail weaving, Yeshkuwu, is mainly geometric. Lots of basketry patterns were utilized from spruce root and cedar bark basket patterns in the last few hundred years, and woven primarily of mountain goat, and black and white in color with sparing use of yellow. In contrast, the Chilkat blanket, or Nahein, or Nahin, or Gwishalit in Semalgic, those woven in the Chilkat technique, as Steve said, use adapted form line design to make them weavable without having us weavers tear our hair out. Very strong primary black lines that you can trace with your finger in most cases, in the distributive designs. And in addition to black and white, the Chilkat blanket, the Nahein, uses blue and yellow in their design fields, or sometimes a greenish, like a beautiful seafoam green or like Kelly green. Let's see, what am I most excited about? Oh, and I should say that both of these textiles have been used, or we want to know, who was making these raven's tail blankets? Why do we not have the name of a raven's tail weaver? Historically, like, we've never been able to attribute one to a specific weaver in history, and Chilkat weaving came back to us, or never really was lost to us in the last few hundred years, that we always had a mentor weaver. Like, we could trace the lineage of that teaching. So what am I most excited about for the exhibit? Just the feeling of being in the space, and feeling that all of that knowledge and beingness, because these are 2,000 hours in the making each, right? So we've got thousands and thousands. We talk about 10,000 hours to mastery. If we've got 20 robes, we've got how many thousands of masters in there? And some of them, we have the first completed blanket by Evelyn Vanderhoop, Haida Weaver. We have a collaborative robe from, many weavers across the Southeast Alaska. It's really, the show has the last robe that my mother, Clarissa Rosal, finished and is just cutting edge, still using the blue and black and white and yellow, but just contemporary in nature. And the way that it's laid out from basketry to these final contemporary pieces, even ending with a piece of mine and Ricky Tagaban's that are kind of taking it off the blanket and making some more contemporary statement pieces. It's just, the flow is just so good. And I'm thrilled. I'm so excited for people to experience this and really know the history and the story and be able to share that out.
So Jackie, you collaborated with Lily and others to present these robes. So what can we expect to see, or do we just have to hold our breaths and wait?
It was Janice Criswell that had the idea around a different way to mount them than just hanging them on the wall. So we actually have, the robes are displayed in, we have some displayed on full mannequins, some that are mounted on the wall, and then some that are on these, it's kind of a slatted wood mount that sort of has the impression of being over someone's shoulder and gives a little bit of motion and I think a little more life to them. So you can expect to see the robes displayed maybe in ways you haven't before. And so it was a very, very exciting thing to work on and to collaborate with Jan on. As Lily was mentioning, just the layout, hopefully people will see sort of from the basketry, raven's tail, the groupings that exist. We have two different robes that are transitional. Those ones are stunning. And then we have an entire side that is all the Chilkat style. And it really, there's some that are up on stages and some on body forms. Besides just robes, we have two tunics that are on exhibit. We have a couple of aprons, a pouch and leggings, and one of Lily's contemporary masks, and an iPhone case by Ricky Tagaban. So just a really exciting display that that I hope brings to life what the weavers were hoping for.
I have to ask, Steve, because this is such an amazing display, especially with the two rare blankets coming from outside Alaska, why you didn't maybe postpone this? Because we don't have celebration right now. That seems like that would be a natural time to have this exhibit. Tourists can't see them because we don't have the big cruise ships coming in. So what's your thinking about going forward with this exhibit?
Well, I think the there's so many moving parts to this, and we had gotten it almost ready to open last year at this time, and then COVID got really bad, and we were really forced to pull the plug on it because those loans were not going to be able to happen given all the restrictions going into place. And so we decided to kick the can down the road. We were disappointed about missing the connection with Celebration. And we weren't really sure what was going to happen, so we put everything on hold. We were able to keep most of the loan pieces that we had gotten already by extending the loans. And when it came time to decide about this year, a call had to be made, and we decided to go forward. And I think it had to do with the momentum that we had going on it already and the hope that we were starting to see light at the end of the tunnel, and that maybe, just maybe, this would be a real morale booster for everybody who could see it. And we realize that not everyone will be able to come, especially with no cruise ships, but we think that a lot of people will get to see it. And so we decided to go forward. And so that's how we got here.
So on Friday, you kind of have your virtual opening ceremonies to welcome all the robes, sort of a soft launch of the exhibit. How can we take part in that? Is there a way virtually to be a part of this?
Yeah, it's we've arranged with KTOO to video the event and live stream it. So if you go to the Alaska State Museum website, you'll be able to find a link to that live stream. It's also going to be recorded, so you could watch it later. And then we'll have it'll be open to the public the Saturday morning, the May 8th at noon, and we'll be open till 4. And we'd like people to make reservations for their visit just so that we can make sure we don't exceed the maximum number of people that make social distancing possible. So if you could call ahead and decide which block of time you want. We also have a couple lectures going on. Lonnie Hotch from Klukwan will be speaking at 1 to 2, and I will be speaking from 3 to 4, and you need to sign up for tickets to see those. We're really limited on space in our auditorium, but those will be taped too and available on the website to watch later if you can't make it down here to see it in person. So, and we are planning other events and opportunities throughout the run of the show. And maybe by the time the show closes in October, things will be business as usual again, and we'll be able to have a really great closing ceremony that more people can come to.
Well, one of the things that's exciting about this is that it's not just a display. It's much more than that. And Lily, I understand you're going to be involved in demonstrating weaving techniques.
That's right. I am in the process of weaving a blanket for a museum in the lower 48, and it is the first of its kind that I know of. I will be there Wednesday, Thursday, and Fridays from 1:15 to 4-ish until the summer schedule opens up. So Wednesday, Thursday, Fridays, pretty much 1 to 4. You can pop in and sit on the bench next to me in your mask and ask me questions. And the other part that I get to sit right next to these beautiful displays that Sophie Lager got to build. She's just graduated with a BLA in Museum Studies and Alaskan Art, but she made these invisible mounts. I mean, they feel invisible because when you walk up to these cases that have like so many colors that Patty Fiorella dyed of the traditional dyes that we could be using in our Chilkat and Raven's Tail blankets. And that, I just geek out over it. It's so beautiful how they're displayed and just the volume of knowledge that is right there in those little plexiglass cases. It's so fun. And describing, you know, the EPI, like what is ends per inch? What is the materials that we use in these? How old is this dye stuff? It's just so fun. So I look forward to seeing you if you can come hang out with me Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, and come learn all about these textiles. I'm so thrilled it's happening.
So Jackie, from a curator's point of view, what makes these blankets stand out all over the world?
Oh, wow. That's an incredible question. I think it's, they're so stunning. They're so, like Lily said, they take thousands of hours to make. It requires being a master weaver to make one of these robes. And, with the circular designs that are in Chilkat being so unique to this area, it really is, you know, some of the best weavings in the world right here in, you know, we're having this exhibit and this right here in Juneau, Alaska, and these weaving styles are, you know, from this area that we live in, and how incredible that, you know, we live here and we have the opportunity to see them and then to get to celebrate them with an exhibit that has, I want to say, close to 24 robes, which to have them in mass like this in one space where you can come see, oh, you know, 24 robes, it's pretty incredible experience. So definitely worth, you know, your visit to the museum and beyond our events this coming week with the opening on Saturday. We're hoping to have something almost monthly. And so there will be different opportunities. Just please stay tuned in for what we have going on. As Lily had said, there's been, lots of weavers that are involved with a dye group, the Chilkat dye group, that have been meeting. And so we're going to have a presentation on that coming up. Also, Lily's going to give a presentation for us in September. So many exciting things to come throughout the entire summer while this exhibit is up.
Well, Steve, I'll let you wrap up our segment here. What do you feel culminates with this exhibit, aside from a long-held dream that passed through the decades, but what is going to happen that's a moment in history?
Yeah, it's, well, for me at least, I think that one of the more significant outcomes of the exhibit will hopefully be for Alaskans and visitors to see how special these traditions really are. Yeah, not only in Alaska, but in the entire world. And I could sense when talking to the curators at these distant museums that we borrowed robes from, how much pride they have in sort of being associated with these incredibly rare and masterpiece quality works of art. And I think that here in Alaska, maybe we have a tendency to take certain things for granted sometimes, and we sort of lose a sense of how special these things are, how people, Alaskan natives, they figured out how to make these things from local materials that they gathered and developed a whole body of knowledge to be able to process them and invented new techniques for making it. They had a vision, but there was no instruction book. They had to write it themselves by figuring things out. And I think you'll see, especially in both the old robes and the new ones, that there's a thread of continuity that runs between them all. And I think it's something to be really proud of. And finally, this is more than just art. It is art, but these are sacred objects. Many of them are sacred to the clans that commissioned them and used them, and that they really fulfill a profound niche in Native cultural ceremonial activities that's as profound as you can possibly imagine, the way that these are used in ceremonies. And that's where the title of the exhibit comes from. The spirit wraps around you. They're used for comforting the bereaved who have lost family members. One of their roles is to wrap around people who are grieving to bring them strength. So we hope too to convey that sense that these are spiritual objects. They're fine art, yes, but also very, very powerful spirit objects.
So Lily, tell us the title, The Spirit Wraps Around You. How does that resonate with you?
It makes all the sense. It brings it full circle, closes the circle, if you will. It, like Steve was saying, this, I'll just go back to this. The spirit wraps around you really is kind of like that movie Chocolat, where she's cooking, and when she's emotional and she's crying into it, everyone who eats the food feels that. A cohort of us, there are about 60 of us weavers who started another collaborative robe, the Giving Strength robe, specifically for sexual and domestic violence survivors. And going into the work, we all decided to weave a 5x5 inch square of weaving, and we're going to stitch them all together with drawstrings, the way that a Chilkat blanket would be assembled. But we'll bring them from all over Southeast. And as we started weaving these squares, we had to talk amongst ourselves and support each other in bringing the strength and bringing the healing to the work, rather than any grief or anger or resentment that could be held toward the perpetrators. So when all of these prayers and strength and healing go into these weavings, and then we piece all these 60 people's prayers together, you can imagine the spirit that wraps around you as you drape that particular blanket over your shoulders. Wow. So that's the embodiment of the work.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there, but those are good things to think about going into seeing this exhibit, The Spirit Wraps Around You. Thank you very much for joining us, Steve Henriksen, Jackie Manning, and Lily Hope. Gunachish.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Every year at graduation, each University of Alaska campus chooses people from the community to recognize. The University of Alaska Southeast has honored Gordon Jackson with a Meritorious Service Award. Jackson is of Thlinkit heritage. He grew up in Cake, attended a boarding school, and graduated with a BA from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in 1969. His big dream at the time was to become a basketball coach, one he never realized because he was tapped to use his degree to improve life for rural Alaskans everywhere. And in many ways, he was still a coach, helping many different teams improve education and health services for Alaska Natives. He wore a lot of hats as an administrator for the Alaska Federation of Natives, as a leader for both Native corporations and tribes, and held a number of key government positions. He was also an important advocate for the Indian Self-Determination Law. I asked Gordon Jackson about wearing all those hats, and he says it felt perfectly natural because the one thread through it all was his love of public service.
A friend of mine recently called me a jack of all trades, having worked in all those different organizations, nonprofit, profit-making, government, many boards and commissions, and even running a first center. You know, I like to learn new things, and it was kind of fun to get into these kind of things and learn how they worked. But I always call it public service, because in any of those organizations, you have a constituency. You know, when you go into a profit-making corporation, you have shareholders, and you try to do the best you can on their behalf. And you go to the tribe and you work for the members. You go work for government and you work for the residents. And it's just kind of fun to learn new things, and I've enjoyed public service throughout my career and life. It's fun.
Would it be fair to characterize you as kind of a Forrest Gump in a way of being in the right place at the right time for a lot of things to happen?
Oh, sure. I think it's a really interesting description, but in many ways I've been at the right place at the right time for many things.
So what are some examples of your tours of duty in different organizations coinciding with historical developments?
I think I was at the right place at the right time at the Alaska Federation of Natives when I was working there in the 1970s. As the Johnson & Mellie director, I moved that program to their original intent, which was designated by the laws. And I was elevated to the vice president of human resources with oversight over all programs and charged with initiating solutions to education, health, and manpower. And we concentrated on changing the educational delivery system to local control. We were pretty successful in Juneau, and in Washington, D.C., Congress was considering a self-determination act that included the Johnson & Mellie program, and we pushed it to include Alaska Native tribes. And this was significant for contracting for Indian Health Service activities and the Bureau of Indian Affairs Services. The bill created 200 tribes in Alaska and enabled them to contract for services and made possible for health corporations. At AFN, we also worked on development of healthcare policy statement that would perhaps govern how things would look when 638 passed. I think that lots of things are happening at the same time. When we start working on solutions, it was almost a 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week job, but got a lot done. It turned into a change in the whole system of education in Alaska, the contracting services for Bureau of Indian Affairs and Indian Health Service. And today, both of the tribes and health corporations are huge employers in Alaska. Give a lot of credit to the health corporations for stopping the coronavirus from spreading and killing a lot of us. And we didn't have those in 1918 when it devastated the Indian villages, when it went through all of rural Alaska. Now you have a good health system in rural Alaska, I think, and I'm glad they're there.
What surprises you the most out of some of the things that you were involved in starting?
What surprised me the most was how significant the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was when it passed in 1971. I and many others worked in the background getting support and human resources to secure its passage. And it's been 50 years since the passage of that act, and it changed the way things run in many villages forever, and it changed how you look at economic development. Went from members to shareholders. And there's going to be much celebration, the passage of ANCSA this year. Everybody will be suggesting how important this act was. And looking at that and thinking about it, I do hope in a few years when Public Law 93638 reaches its 50-year celebration a few years from now, I do hope they do the same thing for this act, because it's a huge employer in Alaska. The tribes employ many, many people. The health corporations run many hospitals in rural Alaska, hire doctors, nurses, scientists, janitors, and did a great job to arresting COVID-19. basically, I think that the success of that is one that really I am surprised at, because without that health system, COVID-19 would be ravaging the state of Alaska and rural Alaska.
Maybe you could speak a little bit to the value of doing so many different things that you had to really teach yourself, and that's a big part of education.
You have to study hard to look at what makes a private for profit making corporation run. It's really, I believe, something that you really need to concentrate on, because in the end, making money is hard work. Putting together these ventures along with of how it's going to operate and how much money it's going to cost, and keeping the shareholders informed, getting the best possible people involved and hired. It was just a hard, it was really, really a challenge. But you studied at night and you worked during the day and really got a lot of stuff accomplished. It was just interesting.
What would you say to the students? They're going to have to keep learning like you did to be able to get out and accomplish things. Is that kind of the message of your career?
Well, education is a lifelong learning process. I always told people, you don't stop learning, you're probably dead. And as I told the University of Alaska Chancellor, when they informed me that I was receiving this, I just said, I appreciate this, but, you know, people in my position would just tell you that we're just doing our job, figure out the solutions and things like that, figured it out and move forward.
Gordon Jackson, recognized by the University of Alaska Southeast for meritorious service. He says he hopes this year's graduates will find room in their futures for public service. This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. The start of the tourism season is always a hopeful time of the year for Juno businesses. And this year, though the economy is struggling from the impacts of the pandemic, everyone is watching for hopeful signs that we've got a light at the end of the tunnel at some point. And our guest, Brian Holst, head of the Juno Economic Development Council, is ever the optimist. Hello, Brian.
Hello. Great to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you with us. You know, we don't have the big cruise ships coming as far as we know it, but we have a lot of small ships lined up for the summer. That has got to help lift everyone's spirits.
It does. And I think you said it great before the break about building an economy. You know, this region was, 50 years ago, a big part of our region was timber. And there were people then in the last many years that kind of wished it wasn't quite as big. And what would be an industry that could replace it? And tourism, what a beautiful solution, where you just come up and you have people's eyeballs enjoying what we have and enjoying our culture. And it's really unfortunate that we're missing that. It's become a really important part of our economy. And without the large cruise ships coming, it's a huge loss. $240 million of spending this year. Yes, we have independent travelers, but that's about 85,000 or so. We have small cruise ships as well, another relatively small number. Important, but it's going to be really unfortunate that we don't have those large ships. Some of the CDC changes, I think we were cautiously optimistic when we heard that the CDC was going to make some slight modifications to the rules. But as a friend of mine said, you know, before the cruise industry was expected to, you know, climb Mount Everest, now they're expected to climb K2. They don't have to test on board. The original idea of the CDC was, let's make a cruise, let's put all the passengers on board, let's show that you can do this with a mock test run for a week and see how things go. They limited that. But now the expectation is that the cruise industry has to have 98% of their crew vaccinated and 95% of the passengers. I think something that people want to see attain, but I think it's going to be really difficult. For that reason, though I'm always optimistic, I'm a little bit pessimistic that the large cruise industry is going to be able to return this summer, and that's going to really hurt our Juno's economy.
Well, one thing we might see is, in isolation, watch the small cruise ship industry unfold by itself. Do you think we'll learn some things from that?
I mean, yes, on the silver lining side of things, what we will be able to measure a little bit better, we have a natural experiment going on, we'll be able to really understand better what is the impact, what does the small cruise industry bring to us, and what does the independent traveler bring to our economy? Both great things, but we're not going to see the great summer jobs that so many of our young people, we all want our young people to come back to Juneau in the summer. It's so often great to see that. Those folks aren't going to have those opportunities with the volumes of small, just the small cruise industry.
So I guess not to change the subject, but I know that you are an avid robotics fan and you have some news for us about some of the robotics competitions that you've been supporting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's super exciting that the high school robotics program just went through its state championship. And on your show a couple months ago, you had the team from Thunder Mountain High School, and they won, first time a Juneau team's ever done it, they won statewide championship in robotics, chain reaction. Super exciting. You had two teams on. You had a high school team from JDHS as well. That team got fifth overall, which was really remarkable. Just says a lot about our kids and their perseverance, their grit, their know-how. Really great to see Juneau teams doing so well.
So you have some announcements for us for the business community.
I do. Today, the Small Business Administration just opened up the application for the restaurant program. Restaurants have been really hard hit, and there's a special program under this new American Rescue Act. And application is open just today, just now. Get out there, go to the Small Business Administration, restaurants.sba.gov. And if you're a restaurant, apply online and get some resources. These are federal programs. There's no local Juneau program at this point. You know, I also want to say that we're excited that the Maritime Festival is going to happen this year. We've met with the Emergency Operations Committee at the city. We've talked about, is it appropriate or not to have an outdoor event? And we've got the green light. Still got to work out some important details, but June 19th, we're going to have the first or the 11th Maritime Festival, and we're going to do it downtown on the docks, and it's super exciting. So if you want to be involved, you want to participate in the outdoor festival, contact us at JDC, maritime@jdc.org is an email, and volunteer. Let us know how you want to participate.
All right. Thank you, Brian Holst. And we will have to continue our conversation about the impact of the cruise ships on the economy and other things that are happening this summer. But thanks for taking time out to be with us today. Brian Holst with the
Juneau. Always great to be here. Thank you.
Economic Development Council. Thank you.
Rainy days and Mondays always get me down.
Well, our next guest, Rick Fritsch, this song, Rainy Days and Mondays. It does seem to fit. Well, Rick Fritsch joins us now. He is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, but he's also joined by a new face at the National Weather Service, Kayla Tinker. So, Rick, I am going to let you introduce another meteorologist that works behind the scenes to help us every day.
Well, good afternoon, Rhonda, and thank you very much for that. I would like to now formally introduce one of our newest meteorologists here at the office, who also has a very keen interest in the climate, by the name of Kayla Tinker, who comes to us from the East Coast with lots of really impressive credentials. As a matter of fact, I think that if you look at Kayla's credentials compared to mine, I should probably just retire.
Oh, Kayla, you need his help, don't you?
I do.
So how are you liking Juneau, Kayla?
I love Juneau. It's been really nice so far, and the past 2 weeks before we got all the rain back in was pretty nice. Had a chance to walk around downtown and go to Sandy Beach and check out other beaches. It has been nice so far.
Well, I hope that you and Rick together collaborate to bring us more days like that. But anyway, Rick, you have some of the stats for April. Was that a very interesting month for you?
Oh my gosh, as they say, or as the younger generation sometimes says. April was really quite the month for us. And I'll have to begin by saying that April is one of those months that we call part of the shoulder season. So it's not quite spring, and it's no longer winter, and it's definitely not summer yet. So you can get any and everything in April, and that is exactly what Southeast Alaska got this past April. We started off with snow and record amounts of snow in some places in Southeast Alaska, and record daily values that Kayla's going to talk to here in a minute. And then later on in the month, I'm sure everybody remembers when the snow finally stopped. And then we started seeing record daily warm temperatures being broken, which was quite pleasant for a lot of folks, I'm sure. And even actually some record overnight lows that were broken because of the clear skies. And then finally, round out the month with nothing less than record daily rainfall amounts. So we pretty much got it all in the month of April, except for maybe record strong windstorms. We didn't have any of those.
Kayla, what do you think about that?
Well, it's been quite a month for sure. I know a lot of us thought that we wouldn't be seeing maybe too much more plowing and shoveling, but you know, March and April kept it going. So our record numbers, and when I say records, we're talking about the airport in Juneau, and the records began in terms of April in 1937. So snowfall April 9th was 5.8 inches of snow, which is the sixth highest snowfall in April on record. And then we started to get some warm temperatures.
Oh, don't forget about that one.
Oh, well, in Yakutat, we had 13.6 inches as well, and that was on April 8th, which is quite unusual.
And there's our normal. We want to bring that up, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
So our normal total in Juneau for snowfall is 1.1 inch, and our total was 10.3 inches.
Oh, my goodness. Quite a bit, yeah. It's almost like 9 or 10 times more snow. Good grief.
Yes, exactly. So if everyone thought this winter was a little bit different in the springtime, it definitely was.
So, Rick, we've got about a minute or so left. So what kind of a month can we expect for May? What do the trends appear to point to?
Yeah, you can. This is June, July, August.
Well, I'll tell you, in terms of May, which is probably going to look a lot like what we expect for the summer, June, July, and August, we have a pretty high probability for warmer than normal temperatures. And when I mean probability, that might be a half a degree warmer than normal, or it might be 5 degrees warmer than normal. That's the thing with probabilistic forecasting. In terms of precipitation, there's no really strong climate signal right now to say how wet or dry the rest of spring and the summer is going to be. But we're hoping and looking forward to a warmer than normal late spring going into the summer.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us, kind of giving us a look back and a look ahead. And Kayla, I certainly hope that you enjoy your time here, and we look forward to learning more, because Rick and others often share all kinds of scientific tips with us that help us understand the weather better. So we're looking forward to that.
Well, we're both glad to be here. Thank you, Rhonda.
All right. Thank you very much, Rick Fritsch and Kayla Tinker with the National Weather Service.
Support for Juneau Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klinkit & Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.